Welcome to The Spot, KALW's weekly space for the best in public radio podcasts and storytelling. I'm your host, Ashley Ann Krigbaum. In radio, we're communicating through sound. That's probably pretty obvious to you. Right now, you're aware that what you're hearing was constructed, written, recorded, and edited to inform and entertain you. At least, I try to. But there is also so much sound in our day-to-day lives outside of the obvious podcasts and radio content that is 100% built. Some are intended to evoke a mood, or mark an action. Some hope to go unnoticed, like a laugh track. But sometimes, the whole point is to get your attention. There's so much research, planning, and production that goes into these sounds. It makes sense that 99% Invisible, a podcast that is all about design and the built world, would choose to dig deeper into how certain sounds are constructed, why, and by whom. In their latest episode, they remind us if something's been constructed, even a sound, there's a good chance someone's probably trying to trademark it. Sorry, I couldn't resist.
This is 99% Invisible. I'm Roman Mars. It's really hard to get a sound trademarked. The first one in the U.S. was issued in 1978 to NBC for their chimes.
MGM has one for their roaring lion, as does 20th Century Fox.
That's 99PI's own Katie Mingle, TM.
Harley-Davidson famously tried to trademark the sound of their motorcycles, that potato, potato, potato sound.
After years of litigation, they finally withdrew their application. So if a bunch of burly bikers can't do it, it must be really hard.
Right now, there are fewer than 200 active trademarks for sounds, even though sound can be super important to brand. Just ask these guys.
My name is Joel Beckerman.
And I'm Tyler Gray.
Tyler and I wrote a book called The Sonic Boom, How Sound Transforms the Way We Think, Feel, and Buy.
Here's a sound that would be, like, impossible to trademark. But Tyler and Joel say it was crucial to building up the brand it's associated with.
We have a steak and shrimp fajita. Very careful, really hot.
Oh man, I know that sound. I know it so well. When I was just a little kid on a cul-de-sac, they built a Chili's in my town. This was before there were really chain restaurants where I lived, so Chili's actually felt kind of novel and exotic. My family was pumped, and our favorite thing to order? The fajitas.
They don't really sell the steak, they sell the sizzle.
In their book, Joel and Tyler use Chili's and their sizzling fajitas as an opening example to illustrate why companies should think more about sound.
You're sitting in a Chili's at the dinner hour at 5 o'clock, and let's say at first nobody's ordering the sizzling fajitas, but then maybe about 20 minutes, 30 minutes into the dinner hour, and I've seen this, all of a sudden one person orders sizzling fajitas.
As the server brings out the sizzling skillet of fajita meat and onions.
And you hear that sizzling sound, literally every eye, every single person in that restaurant, their head turns to the server walking past them, and they follow that server with their eyes, and then they smell the burnt onions and that whole, and now you're hooked. And now everyone orders the sizzling fajitas. And in the back, instead of making that one order, they make 15.
Yeah, they call it the fajita effect.
My family fell victim to the fajita effect too many times to remember. We may even have initiated the original fajita effect, patient zero of the fajita effect.
Chili's, by the way, did not invent the fajita. That distinction goes to a Texan by the name of Sonny Falcone. He was selling a subpar cut of meat called the faja and figured that if you cooked it out in the open with a lot of spice, people didn't care about the quality of the meat.
It got to Chili's because Larry Levine
was the founder of Chili's.
Had seen restaurants around the Rio Grande Valley sort of do their version of it. He had the idea to make sound the star of the show. And so when Chili's opened up, they put that sound of sizzling fajitas in their first ever commercial.
Fajitas sold like crazy. In the wake of their massive success, Chili's printed up t-shirts for staff that said, "I survived the summer of fajita madness."
Now they They serve enough fajita meat to fill 2 nuclear submarines a year.
I really hope someone filled 2 nuclear submarines with fajita meat to get that measurement.
Tyler and Joel say it's surprisingly difficult to get people, even really creative people, to think about sound, to value it in the same way they value the visual environment.
But sometimes there's one person who gets it. At Apple Computers, one of those people was a guy by the name of Jim Reeks.
Hi, my name is Jim Reeks. I am the only person you know whose name is a complete sentence.
Jim worked at Apple for about 10 years, starting in the late 80s.
We didn't really have titles. I don't even think I had business cards.
Well, whatever his title was, Jim was working on sound for the Macintosh computers.
Which was a neglected stepchild of all things Mac. No one really cared about the sound until the end, which is unfortunately typical.
Except Jim. He's a composer and a musician, and he understood the importance of sound more than most of his colleagues. And Jim had strong feelings about the startup sound that was on the Mac at the time.
I just hated it. I just could not stand it.
Here's what it sounded like. Here it is a couple more times because it goes by really fast.
So when Apple first started up, it was, the computer was far from perfect. It crashed a lot.
And every time you turned it back on, you heard that jolting sound. So Jim set out to make a better one.
Your Mac just crashed again. You've lost your work again. You're waiting for this thing to boot up again. That's the audience. Just a bunch of pissed off, frustrated people who are super annoyed and you're wasting their time.
That's a hard audience to play to.
I gotta change everyone's mood. So I was thinking a zen-like meditative sound similar to a gong or chanting om.
Of course, we're all familiar with the sound he came up with.
Oh, that's nice.
So much better, right? Only problem was, Jim asked for permission to put this new sound into the prototype for the new Mac, and
I was told I couldn't do it. We already have a sound, you're not allowed to change it. It was just on and on and on.
But Jim knew the people who were responsible for building the prototype.
I played it for them, and then they liked it. And so when no one was around, we put it into the build.
And the Quadra 700 shipped with the sound in it.
That was back in 1991, when the Quadra 700 Mac cost $6,000. Jim says he never got any props for the sound, just grief. And yet, that sound, with a few minor tweaks, has been the Apple startup sound ever since.
So I think we can assume that Steve Jobs liked it.
It's this big, giant, two-handed C chord, C major chord, that makes you kind of feel welcome to this very stable, very substantial world of Apple. It's probably the single most connected sound with the Apple brand.
And brand is just the experience or a perception prior to the experience. So everything that shapes the perception matters. It would be, like imagine a really beautiful car that just had this horrible engine always backfiring.
Actually, there are people who make sure that beautiful cars sound beautiful, or at least that they sound right. One of them is Sean Carney.
Hi, my name is Sean Carney. I'm the Mustang powertrain sound quality engineer for Ford.
Sean works on Mustangs, and there are all kinds of things he and his team can tweak to get the sound they're looking for.
There's different tubes inside that the exhaust gases will flow through. And those tubes have different shapes and different perforations in them. They have different hole patterns in them. It's sort of like an instrument.
Kind of like you can control the sound of a horn by placing your fingers over different holes, Sean can control the sound of the Mustang. And it's an easier job for the standard V8. But then sometimes they'll put out a specialty Mustang.
In 2008, Mustang decided to put out a remake of a Mustang that appeared in the movie Bullet in 1968. In the movie, there's a pretty famous chase sequence where Steve McQueen drives his Mustang all over the streets of San Francisco.
It's
Sean and his team wanted to make the 2008 Bullet sound similar to the 1968 Bullet.
So when it comes to a car like a Bullet, it's about an old car from an old movie. So yeah, we're trying to make that specific car speak to you in a way of it's drawing you back into those old memories. It's almost like that folklore of what that car might have been.
They're trying essentially to make a new car sound old, which is challenging because cars made in 1968 were built completely differently.
That old engine had a carburetor, we use a fuel injection system, and all those things, just they completely change how the engine can sound.
Sean was never going to be able to duplicate the sound of the Bullet car from the movie exactly. For one, the Mustang in the movie was enhanced with sounds recorded from a race car. And apart from that, it's actually illegal in most places to drive around in a car that loud.
So a big part of what we try to do is we try to identify, what are those key characteristics? Like, what are the notes that are being played by that classic American V8 sound that's in the movie?
When the reviews of the Bullet Mustang came out, people talked about the sound. And most people thought Sean and his team had gotten it right. Here's the 2008 Bullet Mustang in action.
Sound is actually, in terms of all of our senses, it's the one we react to quickest. It's even quicker than touch.
That's Joel Beckerman again.
Brands that are not paying attention to this, not paying attention to sound in association with experiences, they're really going to get punished.
Case in point, in 2010, Frito-Lay decided to come out with a new biodegradable Sun Chips bag.
Only problem was they never considered what that packaging sounded like.
Here's a YouTube video someone made about the bag.
Delicious Sun Chips, love all your products. Thing that I cannot get over is the noise that this bag makes. I don't know what it's made out of. If you ever wanted to get just one little chip out of the bag, I'm actually yelling, and you probably can't hear me. If you want to get one chip out of this bag, good luck.
That guy on YouTube was not the only person to notice how noisy the bag was.
Someone created a Facebook page called "Sorry I Can't Hear You Over This Sun Chips Bag," and it got 40,000 likes, and it became a national news story.
They had to pull the new bag and go back to the old bag. Good intentions, bad execution.
Joel and Tyler refer to this kind of sound as sonic trash.
You know, you'd never let somebody take a bunch of trash and throw it in your front lawn, but we allow cities, our neighbors, brands to really invade our sonic space.
To dump garbage in your ear? Is that what
essentially,
you're saying?
Essentially.
Joel and Tyler imagine a world where all the sounds we hear have more thought behind them, more intention.
It would be very rare that you would actually hear the sound that something made. That thing would trigger a better sound.
In Tyler's world, they could make the Sun Chips bag sound like this when it's opened. Every time you get a chip, you're like, la.
Yeah, except that sound. It's actually on that very short list of trademark sounds. So hands off.
Whatever.
"99% Invisible" was produced this week by Katie Mingle with Sam Greenspan, Avery Truffleman, and me, Roman Mars. We are a project of 91.7 local public radio KALW in San Francisco and produced at the offices of ArcSign, an architecture and interiors firm in beautiful downtown Oakland, California.
I hope when I die, there's a button on my tombstone and you can press it and it would play the sound.
You're listening to The Spot, the show that features the best stories from podcasts and independent radio producers. I'm Ashley Ann Krigbaum. Like we learned in the last story, you can find sound design almost anywhere, including on a plate served at a restaurant. If it's done well, you don't even realize that you're listening to something that's been constructed. The independent podcast Pitch is all about deconstructing music and sharing the stories behind why certain songs sound the way they do. Last year, Pitch creators and hosts Whitney Jones and Alex Kappelman took a good hard look, or I guess I should say, a good hard listen, at how our subconsciousness and our dreams can directly influence a sonic masterpiece.
I'm Alex Kappelman.
And I'm Whitney Jones, and welcome to Pitch. It'll be important to know for this episode that Alex is a musician. Okay.
Pitch is our perception of frequency.
Pitch is how that note sounds when you hear it.
Pitch is...
Yesterday, all my troubles seem so far away. Now it looks as though they're here to stay. Oh, I believe in yesterday, suddenly.
I really love this song. Gorgeous melody, amazing orchestration, and I'm not even a lyrics person, but there's something just really understated and beautiful about the lyrics. But yesterday, all my troubles seemed so far away. Those were not the original lyrics. These were.
Three, four. Scrambled eggs. Oh my baby, how I love your legs.
That's Paul McCartney performing with Jimmy Fallon and the Roots on Late Night in 2010. So yesterday all my troubles seemed so far away, at first was scrambled eggs, oh my baby, how I love your legs. This is Paul McCartney being interviewed for the Beatles anthology documentary in 1995.
I used to live in this little flat up at the top of a house.
What is that sound in the background?
It's his yacht. It's the motor. It's the motor of the yacht that he's on. Anyway, he gets up in the morning.
And I had a piano by the bed. And I just woke up one morning with this tune in my head. So I sort of went to the piano, found the chords to it. You know, I was like in G, F sharp minor, 7, sort of B and that. And
so it's a lot easier to remember a melody when you can sing words along to it, right? So he made up Scrambled Eggs as a placeholder. He was sure that he'd heard the tune somewhere before, and he didn't want to waste more time writing lyrics if the song had already been written.
I don't know this tune, or do I? It's like an old jazz tune or something, and because my dad used to know a lot of old jazz stuff. Well, maybe I've just remembered it or somewhere. And then I just hawked it around to all my friends and stuff and said, what's this? You know, it's got to be something. It's like a good little tune, you know, and I couldn't have written it because I just dreamed it, you know. You don't get that lucky.
He did get that lucky, apparently. Paul McCartney, the genius songwriter. He didn't have to work for this, apparently. Yesterday came to him in a dream.
Yesterday. Love was such an easy...
Hold up. What is that?
That's me asleep, dreaming, and all of a sudden this melody just comes up, and I know it's just really, really good. So I jolt myself awake, I grab my phone, I hit record, and I sing, and that's what came out. And there are actually a lot of stories like this.
Really? There's a lot of stories like this?
Yeah, there are. All right, you want some people? Number one, Wagner, Richard Wagner. He says that he wrote The Ring Cycle while he was dreaming about being overcome by a wave. Giuseppe Tartini, he was dreaming of the devil and he handed the devil his violin and the devil played this crazy piece. And he woke up and he wrote Devil's Trill. All right, now fast forward a few hundred years, man. I talked to a bunch of my musician friends, and they said that they also dream about it.
So I've had this dream for the past year. I've had it maybe 3 or 4 times, where I actually remix Michael Jackson's Wanna Be Startin' Somethin'.
I had a dream where I was conducting an elementary school choir in a performance of Royals by Lord.
As I was playing... I don't know why this happened, but a wave came, like an ocean wave came and washed all of my gear away.
It's always the first part, that first verse, that...
And I was like, oh, man, people, somebody help, I guess, because the gear's washing away, but nobody helped.
So is this something that everybody does?
Well, not quite everybody.
My name is Alan Hobson. I'm a retired professor of psychiatry at Harvard Medical School.
After Freud, Alan Hobson is probably the biggest name in psychology when it comes to dreaming. He has thousands of these things called dream reports, which are basically just surveys of people asking them what they dreamed about the night before. And when I asked him how often people dreamt about music, he basically said, what music?
I've looked at something like 3,000 dream reports, and I can't recall ever reading about the experience of music in dreams. And probably that's a little, that could be exaggerated, but it must be extremely low in the general population.
Those dream reports that Alan Hobson's talking about, they're from college kids and from his own dream journals. So we're not looking at like a dedicated musical population. We're looking at a group that maybe has a few musicians in it.
So we have a few stories of musicians writing songs in their sleep, and then basically no evidence that non-musicians ever dream about music. Is that right?
Not exactly. There is some evidence. In particular, there's this one study that came out in 2005 from the University of Florence in Italy. And that study says that non-musicians actually do report some music in their dreams. But it's important to know that musicians do still dream at a rate that's far higher than non-musicians. It's a significant number.
So am I like this non-musician species and you're this musician type species? Like, what are the differences?
There are a lot of theories when it comes to dreaming. And a lot of them center on the idea that dreams are the processing and replaying of our waking experience. Hobson thinks it's the opposite, that dreams actually prepare us to be awake.
And what I think the brain is doing is getting ready for waking. Now, dreaming is like going into the shop and having your car fixed. They put you up on the ramp, and they pull the clutch out, and they spin the wheels, and they check everything. It's very simple. It's very straightforward. It has to work right in order for you to do the most trivial things that you take for granted as part of your waking experience, like remembering what day it is and, you know, having the plan of action for the day and all these things. I mean, it's incredibly complicated and demanding, but it's done relatively effortlessly. And I say it's done because the brain is prepared by sleep, by dreams, for this experience.
So dreams aren't what's happened to us, but what we're about to do?
He's saying that the mind has so many things that it needs to do just as a baseline for experiencing the world, that it needs a little workout so the muscles don't atrophy. And that's what dreaming is. And he thinks that music is just not a part of that.
I think music is a luxury. And I think music is probably one of the last things that the brain ought to be doing.
So Hobson thinks that's the reason we don't see a lot of music in non-musicians. To non-musicians, music isn't considered an essential part of your day. But I'm going to take it a step further. For musicians, music is more than a luxury. And maybe that's why we see them dreaming about music so often. I can see your gears going right now, Whitney.
Yeah. What if a musician could take control of that and consistently write in their sleep? Has anybody ever done that?
Yeah, actually some people have. This is the song number 3. It's from the album Selected Ambient Works, Volume 2, by the British musician Aphex Twin. He's an electronic musician. He claims that about 70% of this album was written in a lucid dream. So in lucid dreams, you're asleep, you're dreaming, but you're aware that you're dreaming, and you can direct what's happening in your dream. He was interviewed in a 1994 issue of The Face magazine.
I badly wanted to dream tracks.
Okay, just to make this clear, this isn't Aphex Twin. This is a guy named Simon Newton. He's just this British guy that we know. It just didn't feel right reading Aphex Twin in my plain American accent. So this is what he says.
I badly wanted to dream tracks. Like, imagine I'm in the studio and write a track in my sleep, wake up and then write it in the real world with real instruments. The hardest thing is getting the sounds the same. It's never the same. It doesn't really come close to it. When you have a nightmare or a weird dream, you wake up and tell someone about it and it sounds really sh**. Well, it's the same for sounds, roughly. When I imagine sounds, they're in dream form. As you get better at doing it, you can get closer and closer to the actual sounds.
Whoa.
Yeah, if it's true, it's really crazy. The lucid dreaming community is actually really big, and people are really into it. Let me introduce you to Thomas Pizell.
My name is Thomas Pizell, and I'm an author and speaker on lucid dreaming.
Thomas wrote a book called A Field Guide to Lucid Dreaming, and he teaches people how to lucid dream.
There's so many reasons to lucid dream. In the beginning, when I first started out as a teenager, it was just about fantasy fulfillment. It was about me flying around, doing whatever I wanted. But then it started becoming about asking questions, receiving guidance and insight. And for me, I think it ultimately opens us up to a bigger picture of who we are. I think it can show us that we're a lot more than just physical bodies and beings.
So that's a common thread in the lucid dreaming community. If you speak to a lot of lucid dreamers, you're going to hear a lot of mystical type stuff. But I'm not interested in that. I just want to know how Aphex Twin did this. I want to go into my dreams. I want to tap into my creativity, and I want to write a critically acclaimed album. So that's what I told Thomas. And he said that he's taught a lot of artists how to do that.
Writers who have lucid dreamed with their characters and had conversations with them to understand their motivation behind things. Painters painting, you know, using just that landscape as your canvas.
And musicians writing songs.
My name is Jennifer Clarascura, and I am a dream mentor and a hypnotherapist.
So in addition to being a lucid dreamer, Jennifer also used to be a musician. And she told me that she's written a few songs while she was lucid dreaming. Here's her describing one of the songs that she wrote called Unknown Dream.
Well, I woke up with the sort of like the bass of it, which was just a simple note. It was very basic, like doom, doom. It wasn't anything major. I just grabbed the guitar and I found that right note of that bass, and that's how it happened. It was just boom, boom, boom.
So I don't want to kill anybody's buzz, but are we just supposed to take the musician's word for it that they were dreaming and they wrote this melody and these lyrics? Or, I mean, that's a way better backstory than like, oh, I was wandering through Walgreens and I saw this toothpaste that...
Yeah,
I don't know.
Right.
Like,
these are all anecdotal stories, and they're all like really hilarious or interesting or really badass in a really specific way. And I had the same reservations until a couple weeks ago when I was dreaming and I became lucid.
Did you write a song?
Well, at first I was like, oh, snap, I'm in a lucid dream. Like, let's fly somewhere. Then I was like, no, calm down, Alex. Write a song.
I can go in my mind. I can go in my mind.
All right, so this one also probably won't be on the top of the Billboard chart. But it's a real thing, man. Like, I wrote this in a lucid dream. It happened.
So you're doing a story on writing music in your sleep, and suddenly you have a lucid dream, and you write a song.
All right, I know it seems totally crazy, but think of it this way. Everyone's dreams are totally crazy. These are just totally crazy dreams with new songs in them. For musicians, it doesn't matter where an idea strikes you. Whether you're awake, whether you're asleep, whether you're in a lucid dream or not. No matter how you're writing music, you need that special spark. The question is, does the muse treat you any differently when you're dreaming? This episode was produced by me, Alex Kappelman, and Whitney Jones. Special thanks to Dr. Irving Massey, Tony Harrington, Simon Newton, Matt Siffert, Ryan Deeringer, Alex Weston, Mal Blum, Robert Sarazen Blake, Jason Brander, and my peeps on the Lucid Dreaming subreddit.
If you'd like to hear more from Pitch, you can find their show on iTunes and on their website, hearpitch.org.
I've got dreams to remember.
That's it for today's episode of The Spot. You can find this episode and more at kalw.org. Look at the homepage for the little blue letters that spell out The Spot. And tell me what you want to hear on The Spot. If you have a suggestion for a podcast we should feature, please drop me a line at thespot@kalw.org. Or maybe there's a story you've heard that you'd like to request or dedicate to someone. I would love to hear about it. My email again is thespot@kalw.org. Tune in next Thursday, same time, for a whole new episode of The Spot, only on KALW San Francisco.